Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
This episode is brought to you by Jack Henry Digital, the pioneer and creator of personal digital banking that helps community financial institutions translate their trust and live, local, personal service meaningfully into digital channels for the first time.
And you're on Breaking Banks, and joining me this week, we're going to get straight into it, no hesitation, is Brian Claggett, newly released from indentured servitude, semi-retired. Right. Chloe James Glober is back with us to host. Chloe.
Well, first time with that new surname.
It is. Yes, exactly. Joining as a guest for us today, and I'm sure he'll end up turning the tables on us at some point with some questions of his own, is James Robert Lay, the author of a new book called Banking on Digital Growth, a Strategic Marketing Manifesto to Transform Financial Brands. Remind me to talk to you about shorter subtitles, JR. No, just joking.
Hey, anything that helps, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No. So, Brian, tell us about what's been happening with you, because after the Geezeo acquisition, you've been doing a few things, right?
Yeah. So it's almost been a year. It'll be a year in July. In the past year or so, I've been running strategic initiatives at Strategy Corps, working with their managing team, their executive team, in a number of capacities. They're exciting times, obviously, for the industry and for the business right now because of what's happening with margin compression. And our product is one that drives fee income in through the demand deposit or checking accounts or share drafts, depending upon whether you're a banker or credit unioner. So it's been a delight. It's a great team. I'm going to continue working with them. I'm looking forward to smelling the roses a bit, plus doing some other exciting things. You and I are even talking about a couple of new things down the road, but I am going to stay very close to Strategy Corps and working with Dave. We're going to be hosting some events for him and probably be doing a little travel with him as well. So I can't wait.
So it's definitely semi-retired.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to go from probably an 18-hour workday to 12.
There you go. Yeah.
All my friends are like, I don't see you really chilling out, Brian.
Yeah.
It's like no rocking chair for you. Nope. No, maybe the next week I'll take off.
Yeah. And CJ, how's the baby going?
She's good. She's asleep. So she won't be squealing on this episode of Breaking Banks like she was last time, I think, before I went on mute. But yeah, life's good.
How are you managing?
Bunkering down here.
Yeah. How are you managing with the time zone shift, given you're still doing work with RFI in Oz, right?
Yeah, I am. I mean, my role is global. We are just, I think people do know, but RFI, we do consumer research and financial services, and it's a global role, and there's obviously a lot of research going on and given COVID. I was the first person to say that word on this episode, oh my goodness. But yeah. we're really busy and just seeing what consumers are doing all over the world. One of the biggest pieces we're doing at the moment is on mortgages, actually, and it's just all about just mortgage deferrals and huge numbers across Australia and actually Canada, where I'm based, really kind of suffering here and people really feeling the pinch.
Yeah, the mortgage side of things is going to take a hammering globally.
Oh, yeah.
We haven't even started to really see the impact of that yet. So,
And on the commercial side as well.
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, well, absolutely.
Yeah. Commercial real estate.
Everyone's moving out.
Yeah.
That shoe's going to drop.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was under threat already. I mean, we've been talking about decline in branches. We've been talking about decline in malls and retail spaces well before COVID-19. And so what do you do in the midst of COVID-19? Well, you launch a book, right, JR?
Great segue.
James Robert, you're obviously, you've got a ton of experience in digital marketing. You're the CEO of the Digital Growth Institute. You've worked with more than 500 financial brands. Your latest book, is this your first book?
This is the first of a series.
Banking on Digital Growth, the Strategic Marketing Manifesto to Transform Financial Brands. So first of all, obviously, you know, coronavirus has changed all the rules in respect to this. So where are the biggest weaknesses right now for incumbents? Where have they been hammered in respect to marketing engagement, you know, and connecting with customers as a result of the restrictions placed on them with coronavirus?
You know, I think the easy answer would be technology, but I think the answer behind that is a lack of awareness of how people shop and buy financial products and services. You know, working with, you know, dozens over the last few months, it's now like, oh, wow, there's more than an awareness and a purchase stage. There's something that sits right in the middle, which is the biggest gap, which is really consideration in these journeys.
Did you see that that report from FIS coming that came out, I guess, about a month ago, that they're showing that mobile usage is up 200%?
Yeah, that's incredible. I think, you know, one of the core elements is we see a lot of focus from banks historically on self-service. So, you know, they came to the web with self-service. They really weren't interested in acquisition in the early days. But then as obviously online competitors, digital pure plays, challenges and so forth came along, they had to up their game on the acquisition side. But one thing that they never appear to have really got you know, in the same way that challengers do, and Brian, you know, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this as well, is that, you know, there's a whole lot in between, you know, having someone self-service, you know, from a cost reduction perspective as the bank, and then acquiring them for new products. There's all this day-to-day relationship engagement, you know, mechanisms for making a customer feel like they're connected with the brand. And yet I can tell you from the majors that I have relationships both here in the US and in Hong Kong and even Australia, I've had nothing on the relationship side during coronavirus beyond you know, the usual corporate social responsibility speak. Whereas all the, you know, I'm getting on a daily basis something from one of the challenges that I'm, you know, a customer of, with all sorts of different types of engagement. So the gulf there is massive. Why don't they get it?
It comes back to, there's a lack of awareness. There's a lack of understanding. You know, whenever we go in and we work with a financial brand and you survey and you talk to the executive team, you start there, you ask them, define digital growth. And they define that as the service side that you mentioned. It's the mobile banking, the remote deposit. We're set. We're good. We got the loan platforms, the LOS. But the challenge with that comes from the DX and the HX, the digital experience and the human experience combined. It's not one, it's not the other. It's both of them working in conjunction, hand in hand.
Yeah, Brian?
Yeah. Well, I would add to that. I think the fintechs are using data a lot better, to be honest with you. There's a disconnect as far as I'm concerned. And there's been one even prior to the pandemic hitting. I know that the Jack Henrys and the Jeezy's of the world are working on enriched data. And that's a direction that they're right. In the right way, but they're just, you know, the banks are just not leveraging it the way that they could. And so there's a disconnect there. Also expectations. I kind of expect my bank to reach out to me progressively right now. And I'm not seeing it. I've got two primary relationships at two very large financial institutions. And everything I get from them is the standard form letter. They're not looking at the kind of relationship I have and maybe the specific needs I have.
Do you think the traditional banks, just throwing it out there, are just overwhelmed? Like, is that what the big problem is? They're just overwhelmed with, one, getting their whole workforces and teams to now be remote. That the customer is coming so far second, whereas some of those challenger banks, you know, we obviously know they're so much leaner and they can move so quickly and just implement things. So, Brett, you say you know, you're probably getting great information from them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering where the break is, and if it is that just overwhelming like panic almost that they can't be specific to, you know, their hundreds of thousands of customers.
Yeah, I definitely think there's some of that occurring, but I guess what's the excuse prior to the pandemic? Yeah. You know, the behavior wasn't there before. I mean, you know, they've got all the information about me and my family. My kids were young. No one ever approached me and said, "Hey, we know you. We see you have savings accounts for your kids. Have you thought about a 529?" Raymond James did, Vanguard did, USA didn't. My bigger bank didn't. I got an email the other day, actually, from a really big bank saying, have you considered preparing for retirement? Well, I'm retiring tomorrow. So they're really out of step with me. So if I'm not prepared for tomorrow, I'm pretty much screwed. So it's, you know, I think the pandemic is adding to the frustration. I think the pandemic's actually going to be good for the industry longer term, provided we get through this, but they just haven't been using the data in the past.
Do you think in the Banking and Digital Growth book, I just wanted to have a little chat there on that sort of physical branch versus digital, you know, this digital experience that people are having. I mean, is this all over as we know it, or are there still going to be, I mean, is it going to transition back that people still will want that branch experience? Has it completely changed? Like, I mean, just because of the last few months, so many people who had never, you know, done any digital banking experience in their whole life are now doing it. And so actually realizing that it's really handy and convenient. Although I will say that there is a bank that still wants a check from me about something, and I'm just bashing my head against the wall about the fact of that.
It's about taking a proactive versus a reactive stance in a person's life. You know, we've all alluded to, we have all of this data. We probably know some, you know, better about a person's financial health than they do themselves. And if we can step up and provide them with that guidance and that recommendations, everyone wins. Will we go back? Absolutely not. Like, new behaviors, new habits are being formed forever. And to Brian's point, I think we're all going to be better off because of this in the long term. Yes, there's a little bit of a struggle right now, but if we can get past this in our own minds, the future's bright.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me a bit more, James Robert, about the digital blueprint concept that you introduced in the book.
Yeah, so the digital growth blueprint, it takes the old kind of the 9 P's of marketing: price, place, product, promotion. And now we have the 9 P's of digital growth. And it all starts in the heart, the center, which is really built around purpose. And this isn't intended to be some touchy, feel-good stuff. This is really aligning the financial brand to the needs of the people in the communities, in the world, if you will, that they serve. Because once we identify that, we're seeing a lot of that play out in fintech, in the challenger banks. They are building around purpose. Aspiration is one that pops to the top of my mind. Then we can align everything else: our product positioning, the personas that we're looking to help, the processes in which we bring those to the marketplace to bear. And then most importantly, that kind of like that fifth ring, if you will, is pathways. It is the consumer journey and how they go through from awareness to consideration to purchase. That's the top of the funnel. Then it's the onboarding. It's the referrals or the activations of advocates, which once again, we see that with the challenger banks. They're leaning into digital referrals as an organic growth model.
And Brian, I'll just, before Chloe jumps in here, I've got a quick question for you. I mean, you've worked a lot more with incumbent players, you know, in your time with Geezeo. Have we as yet got to the point where digital marketing spend is eclipsing, you know, traditional marketing spend, or are we still behind on that?
We're crossing that threshold. I don't know if it's still the right digital spend.
Okay.
Right. It could be quote unquote digital advertising as opposed to digital engagement, which is really leveraging that enriched data and turn it into a predictive mechanism that presents the right offer at the right time. There's also a disconnect, I think, in the education of what really digital is. Some would argue that, you know, organizations like community banks and credit unions need to have a digital culture. I think that's true. They need to think more in terms of digital. But I like where James Roberts gone with that kind of high tech, high touch, that human interaction combined with that digital engagement or user experience. I think that's where the rubber hits the road. I think it's a competitive advantage conceptually to a bank.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think Brett mentioned at the top of the show, you know, where the banks were being pinched on that cost and what they've got to kind of spend. And I would have thought marketing, it's often one of the first areas to go, unfortunately. So thinking with this digital marketing piece, what is the smartest way to do it, James Robert? What are you advising your, you know, clients and customers? What's the best, smartest, most effective way to market?
We've used the word overwhelming. So if we can like distill this down and really focus on three key areas, what I call TLC, It's traffic, it's leads, it's conversion. Where do we start? We start from the bottom and work our way up to the top. Because to Brian's point, the more money that we pour into the top of the funnel to the advertising, if we don't have the proper systems in place to convert and acquire customers, accounts, loans, we're just adding complexity to that problem and people are going to feel more frustrated and overwhelmed, particularly those when you have to report back. And that's why marketing, there's a huge distrust internally with marketing, which is often why it's one of the very first things to get cut, because it's viewed as a cost, not a growth area. So we have to focus on improving the conversion part of the funnel first and foremost. And a lot of that can be done by just capturing things organically.
Mm-hmm. Another challenge, I think, Chloe, is that a lot of marketers, especially we'll call them older school marketers and older school bankers, view digital as email. You know, they do. There's many that do, and that's a disconnect. I could argue that email's dead.
Yeah,
you're not creating that engagement banking that you and I talked about years ago, Brett, by doing that, right?
You know, 2010 and 2011.
2010,
engagement
right?
Banking.
Engagementbanking.com.
We were so far ahead of the time, man. Yeah.
But now, you know, we're literally at the point where that vision is coming to fruition. And that, again, is that high-touch environment where we're very contextual and very relevant. There's no relevance in how my bank approaches me. Yeah. And my data examples earlier were a good indication of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
In such an unstable time for customers, consumers out there, surely this is a time that switching could potentially be high. So, you know, if your marketing strategy is right, this is a great time to acquire those new customers who are, you know, dissatisfied, frustrated, getting emails saying, can we talk about your retirement plans, even though you wanted to retire 2 days ago?
Well, I think about like a recent study that we did. It's rooted in digital secret shopping, which I find it's kind of odd. You know, we secret
shop. Is this like mystery shopping or what is it? Digital secret shopping.
Yeah, it's like you have the mystery shop of the branch experience. Okay, that's great. Mm-hmm. You know, in 1999, right. It's the same type of a principle, but you're doing it through the digital channels with the lens of acquisition. We were doing this for a financial brand recently, and just basic contact form outreach. There was no contextual part of the follow-up. They had an opportunity to lean into the pain point that was submitted and provide some guidance into, well, what's the offer? Instead, they just decided to link this person doing the testing off to the rates page, which provided no context. There was no help. There was no hope.
And even when I'm on the rate page, there's no call to action. There's that part.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lack of digital auditing that's occurring in essence.
So you guys have really identified two major components of this. One, the data piece, which leads to the ability to predict the customer's needs or respond in real time. And the second piece of this, the ability to build compelling experiences that engage the customer. But most banks don't even have departments for those things yet. So, you know, where do you start? Jay, do you want to have a first shot at that and then we'll get to Brian?
Digital anthropology, the study of how people and technology interact and engage to create value. And, you know, if I was to look at this, I would actually take a look at the experience side of things first. And what I mean by experience is that's being well-defined systems and processes that have been three things. They've been, first and foremost, they've been defined. Second, they've been applied. And here's the secret. They've been optimized over a set period of time. I think a lot of experiences from financial services, we get something, we put it on the shelf and then we check it off and then we move on to the next thing. We have to come back and define and redefine how we can make those experiences better, because an experience results in one of two things, a positive emotion or a negative emotion. Positive, hey, I'm ready to apply, open the account, great. Once you have those in place, then you can add some data to start driving traffic through the contextual basis of whatever the person's problem, pain point that we're trying to solve with.
Yeah, Brian. Well, don't even get me started on like compliance and process and policy that constrain that sort of thinking. But
yeah, we were just talking about that in another event I was doing earlier. I think the issue is really one of commoditization. I think you know, banks are fundamentally a utility to the average consumer, and I think the bankers have to have a come to Jesus moment where they just admit to themselves, you know, fundamentally banking sucks. It's not something anyone wants to do. It's not something someone looks forward to. You know, hey, honey, I can't wait to go home, spend a romantic weekend paying the bills. Or, hey, let's go apply for a mortgage for a good time. You know, if banking is a chore. It really stinks. And so they need to have like kind of that come to Jesus moment, and then they need to look at it from the top down. You know, how are we as an organization truly customer-centric? And what tools will it take, and what cultural change will it take in order for us to become customer-centric? And these are the things that James Roberts' book really touch upon, is how you change it philosophically. But there are a lot of bankers out there that are doing business as usual. And I think the COVID event, as we'll call it, is going to change that. It's going to change it because the customer is truly in charge, not the banker. You know, the fintechs do understand that the experience can be better. They're leveraging data. They're being contextual. They're being relevant, right? And they understand that banking is never going to be as romantic as some bankers think it will be. As long as they view it as the way it is today, they're not going to succeed. The bankers have got to change their mindset.
They're much heavier incentivized, the fintechs, to fix this. They've got, you know, they've got many more metrics looking at acquisition and engagement and, you know, share of wallet and all of those things, which banks are like sitting on their laurels, right?
Yeah. Burn rate will do that. That'll motivate you.
Tell me about it. Yeah. So JR, you know, in the book, tell us about some of the better experiences you call out as indicative of an organization that's got this underhand or under control.
I think one of the very first types of experiences is just gaining clarity into what the opportunities are. One of the things I write about in the book is we're held back by these four fears: the unknown, the change, failure, and even success. And we have to help the unaware become aware of what the opportunities are to begin with. And once we do that, I find that that's when progress begins, because someone's level of courage increases, their level of commitment. Because how many times has someone started down this path, down this journey, and something doesn't go as planned, and we pull back? We view that as failure. Failure in this digital space, that's a learning opportunity. And in financial services, we are so risk adverse. We don't want to even have that conversation around failure. I heard a CEO say it the best. Failure is our university experience in this digital world. It's the cost of tuition.
Mm. Yeah, that's a very good statement.
And you absolutely need the leadership. So your chief digital officer at any of these, you know, major traditional organizations needs to lead with that sentiment. James Robert, would you try? Otherwise, it's not going to stem through to the rest of the organization. Then you aren't going to get change. Because I know there's so much talk about all of this, but you actually have to have it implemented and driven through.
It has to be top down, bottom to top. And I can, you know, I give a story in the book of a vice president of marketing at a sizable financial brand. They started down this journey. 12 months in, she's calling me in a panic saying, our board is freaking out. Our executive team is freaking out. They're upset. Where are our billboards? Where are our newspaper ads? And I said, just let's pause, let's breathe, let's get into the heart of the matter. And so went out, we talked through it with the board, the executive team, and we just had a conversation, how they shop, how they buy. And it wasn't even about financial products, it was just, you know, commerce in general. That's when the self-actualization light turned on, and they said, you know what? We're okay with this. And once they had that like sense of calm and peace, then everything else started to fall into place.
I wish someone would have that conversation with HSBC, but you know, if we look at the whole fintech environment, obviously you've got a bunch of challenges entering the markets here, and they've done very well. You know, some have done well, you know, in terms of traction, Varo Money and so forth in UK, obviously Monzo, Starling, the Revolut, 1026s of the world. Now, we have seen banks like Chase with Finn and RBS with Bo basically try and replicate what the challengers have done but fail. Why do you think, Brian, I'll start with you, why do you think they weren't able to get there even though they were just sort of trying to replicate what the challengers were doing?
Yeah, I think, well, for one thing, I don't think they're embedding an experience. You know, they're looking at it as a siloed activity or siloed product. I think the ones that are really doing a good job would be Goldman and Marcus. You know, they seem to really kind of get it. But unfortunately, I think people are buying and leveraging fintech because it's apropos, as opposed to the realization that this is truly a pivot, that we can leverage fintech, that high-tech, high-touch kind of experience, to decommoditize the industry, remove the friction that the industry is fraught with, and actually move the needle. Again, that's digital, right? That's a digital posture that these banks can take. But again, if they treat fintech as the enemy and as only as a threat, they're missing the opportunity. James, Robert, yeah. What do you think?
You know, it's about literally flipping the business model, because to this point, digital has been a bolt-on to the old legacy model of the physical world of branches of broadcast. But when you flip the business model to be digital first, you're literally flipping and turning people's worlds upside down.
Entirely new metrics, entirely new culture. Yeah.
But flipping the world upside down, isn't that what's just happened? So is this not the absolute moment? Brett, I know you agree with that. Yeah. This is the moment then. I mean, we have to be digital now. Everything, every single aspect of our life has to be able to function digitally, or we just, you know, we can't really continue.
This has been a forcing function. This has been like the time where you go to the doctor and the doctor's looking at your charts and saying, you know what? You need to eat better. You need to start an exercise program, because if you don't do this now, something not very good is going to happen in the not so distant future.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Just before we go to break, JR, just in respect to the book itself, tell me about the process of writing this. How long did it take you? And you know, what was the process you went through?
So it started May of 2019, the writing process. And that was about an 8-month experience. And once we got to 2020, I was like, this is going to be good. We're going to have some knowledge that we can bring to bear into the marketplace to help other people, which was my whole reason of writing the book, was just to transfer everything that I've learned over the last 20 years of my life, what I've seen, what I've studied at scale, to help, you know, I believe a rising tide raises all ships. And so then we had this little thing called COVID come out starting February, March. And I called the publisher and I was like, you know, I think we should hit the pause button at least for a month just to see where things go. And whenever we launched this about a month ago, mid-May, the response has just been absolutely overwhelming. So it's been
fantastic.
All right, well, look, awesome.
Absolutely. Let's just take a quick break. And after the break, let's get into some more insights on how you navigate from a marketing and strategy perspective out of the coronavirus. We'll be right back with Breaking Banks after these words from our sponsors. The SBA issued final guidance on the PPP loan forgiveness, but now there are more questions than answers. Like, what if the loan forgiveness process is such a pain that borrowers don't complete the forgiveness and the lender's stuck with a bunch of low interest loans? How do banks make sure they're 100% compliant when the feds come looking to review? AlphaRank helps answer all these questions by automating the entire process. It's sort of like a TurboTax for PPP loan forgiveness. There's no integration required. You just sign paperwork and start using AlphaRank's tools in less than 48 hours. And they're trusted by major financial institutions, and they've got partnerships with numerous state banking associations and the likes of MeridianLink. How do you get to check it out? Visit alpharank.io/BrettKing to learn more. That's alpharank.io/BrettKing. Mention you heard this ad on the Breaking Banks podcast and get a 20% discount.
This episode is brought to you by Jack Henry Digital, the pioneer and creator of personal digital banking that helps community financial institutions translate their trust and live, local, personal service meaningfully into digital channels for the first time. Jack Henry Digital helps community financial institutions strategically differentiate their digital offerings from those megabanks, big techs, and fintechs. So how did they do it? With the Banno Digital Platform, a complete 100% API-enabled open digital banking platform. You get beautiful, lightning-fast native apps and integrated PFM for your customers and members, and cloud-based, core-connected back-office tools for your employees. And with website, marketing, and content management capabilities built in, community banks and credit unions can create, launch, and track targeted campaigns quickly from click-through to product acquisition across all digital channels. My favorite part of the platform is Banno Conversations, a first-of-its-kind, fully authenticated, secure chat capability that puts branch staff front and center in real time at the moment of need, extending the relationship-based banking model and restoring community financial institutions' ability to sell in the context of live digital service. You really have to see this feature to fully understand its potential. Visit Banno.com to schedule a demo today. That's Banno.com.
Supporting contract employees and the gigging economy is more important than ever during the coronavirus crisis. So if you're a business owner, chances are at some point you're going to need some flexibility in your workforce. You're going to need to bring in some people with special skills, a freelancer, maybe a designer, a copywriter, someone involved in coding, setting up a website. You know, we need voiceover actors sometimes for our work at Breaking Banks. So where do you go to find the right experience, have predictable costing, and hire freelancers with proven track records and clear pricing? If you want a solution to this, go to Fiverr.com. Fiverr has the ability to offer meaningful resources to help small businesses transition into the new normal of the post-coronavirus world. They connect businesses with freelancers offering hundreds of digital services. You can work with confidence. You can search by the type of service you're looking for, deadline, price reviews, and more. You know exactly what you're paying for up front, no hourly rates or negotiation, and payments only released once the freelancer has completed the work and you approve it. 24/7 customer service anytime you have an issue. Find your talent today at Fiverr.com and receive 10% off your first order using our code BREAKING. All the digital services you need are in one place at Fiverr.com, code BREAKING. Again, that's Fiverr.com, code BREAKING.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
And now, here's more Breaking Banks.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. Chloe James here with Brett King, obviously. We've had a great session before the break there, speaking to James Robert Lay, CEO of Digital Growth Institute, about his best-selling book, Banking on Digital Growth, which he cleverly just brought out during the coronavirus COVID-19, but it's going very well for him. Great chat there. And also Brian Claggett, good friend of Breaking Banks, the Director of Strategic Initiatives for Strategy Corps. So, now we are going to talk about life post COVID-19. I'm really keen to hear what Brett thinks is going to happen post COVID-19. So I'm going to kick it over to
me,
you, Brett.
You want me to start? Okay.
Where's your crystal ball?
I'm being interviewed. All right.
That's assuming there is going to be life post-COVID.
Yes. I'm obviously writing on this at the moment. I've had to actually rewrite my new book, JR. So, in a good way, coronavirus actually is an incredible supportive thesis for the stuff that I've been writing about for my new book, The Rise of Techno-Socialism. But getting into, if you look at historically, you know, how we responded to pandemics in the past, there are some very good lessons from this. The Black Plague in the late 1300s, early 1400s in Europe, it radically changed European society, you know? And so the biggest change was the fact that, you know, you had this feudal system with where inequality was rife. Sound familiar? And you know, there was a rapid change because the laborers who were out on the farms and out of the cities, because they weren't, you know, permitted to live in the cities because they weren't wealthy enough, generally speaking, they fared better than people who lived in cities, you know, the wealthy elite. And so, you know, after the plague, they were able to come in and sort of, you know, take up residence in these houses that were, had been abandoned by people who died. In some cities, you know, 2/3 of the population, you know, had been affected. You go to
wiped out.
You know, if you go to the Spanish flu, which, you know, don't even get into the whole, you know, why it was called the Spanish flu issue. But one of the biggest changes emerging out of that was organized healthcare. Because, and despite where we're at today in the United States, if you look at hospitals in the UK, you know, Europe and US prior to the First World War, most of healthcare was provided by a physician in your community. Even surgery was done by your MD, your family doctor. The hospitals were there for hospice and palliative care. You know, they were run by nonprofits for people with long-term illnesses. They weren't places you'd go for emergency. There was no emergency department. There was no surgery department, things like that. And so that was a radical shift, and it was funded by public money for the first time, the creation of hospitals. So we have some patterns to sort of fall back on. So if you look at what's affected people most coming out of coronavirus, you know, or as a result of coronavirus, certainly inequality and the systemic racism issue in the United States, that is, you know, that's fed by the issue of inequality, obviously. It's hit people in poorer communities much, much harder than it's hit people who are wealthy, you know, and you know, better off. So this is going to require a reset. We're going to have redistribution of resources. We're going to have, you know, there's going to be an increased social consciousness coming out of that, with an emphasis on how, you know, we can provide better for society. The other element of this is just purely what broke in terms of capitalism's ability to respond to this. You know, the ability to, we didn't have reserve PPE. We didn't have reserve ventilators because it wasn't seen as efficient in a capitalist system. And so we have to now start saying, well, there are some things that are more important than profits of pharma companies, right? And profits of medical companies. We have to have these basic things in place for society. And the same for universal basic income, right? Where we must have a social safety net. Because if you have 30% unemployment, which is where we're going to potentially in the US, you know, you can't just say they're on their own. You know, that's no longer sufficient. Again, it's accentuated by inequality. So that's sort of my view of the forces that will emerge. I think we're going to have a lot of pressure on the system around capitalism that's created this level of inequality and a much more sort of more of a social consciousness coming out of this. There are other issues, supply chain issues and global communication and cooperation and things like that, but I'll leave that for now. But
speaking of this sort of social conscience piece, Brian, did you want to jump in there a little bit about the work that you do around culture? And I know that you've been running these happier hours. I've got that right. Bring that in, because how are you bringing that sort of culture piece, given this time of, you know, uncertainty? And Brett's just outlined beautifully, you know, how dreadful things are in many parts of the world. So how are you working with teams?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's been a challenge. It's actually been, it's been a lot of fun, to be honest with you. There's been some advantages of it. You know, we've got a workforce, about 80 employees throughout the United States. The bulk of them are located in Nashville. Most of us are road warriors. So we're kind of like stripped. Our wings have been clipped, in essence.
Tell me about it.
We're stuck on, I mean, it's all of us, right? I mean, it's a unique personal challenge as well as a logistical challenge. So we had this idea, and it started with Dave DeFazio, one of our partners, and he thought, you know, we ought to host like a weekly or bi-weekly event called the Happier Half Hour. So our marketing team got together, and you know, we found organizations that needed to raise money, and we found entertainers, educators, musicians that could provide some entertainment and kind of offer a little levity in the stressful times. It was good for our employees. It was good for the market. We invited our clients and our prospects, influencers, and we raised a little money along the way. We raised several thousand dollars for a variety of charities. So that was a real positive thing. And others did it too. You know, one of the things that I noticed as being a marketer at heart is that a lot of organizations put a lot of words out there. And I think what we did was neat, was we actually put our money where our mouth was. We actually did something. And we've had just under 50,000 viewers on Facebook of the venues or the events that we've held so far. So that's been great. I think it even has legs. It might be something that we continue in the future somehow. Giving back to community is a very important component to our DNA. It's important, obviously, to the industry as well. And I don't mean just fintech. I mean the entire banking ecosystem. But it's been great. I've really enjoyed it.
That's awesome. So, I mean, given the inequality that Brett's been talking about, I think people generally do want to give back in some capacity during a time like this.
Yeah, I'm the chairman of the Center for Child and Family Services here in Hampton Roads, Virginia. And, you know, it's been a real challenge for us because, again, our entire team's located in an office. So they've all been remote. So the first thing we had to do was get grants to buy these people laptops. And we serve the underserved market, people that just they're not on the high rung of the economic ladder. They're at pretty much the very bottom. And to see the impacts that they've had, and it goes back to what Brett said before, you know, there's a certain percentage of the market that's very much insulated from this. And then there's a vast part of the market, which has really taken it on the chin. But that's been difficult because we had to retool our staff to be able to help these people. Plus, we've got people. The good news is a lot of the lower echelon are on mobile devices. They don't have landlines. So they are able to interact with us virtually. So we actually had to retool from a virtual perspective as well. But yeah, these are interesting times. It makes me Fantastic. Wonder what the bankers have on their minds right now. Yeah. They must really be...
Well, look, we do need to wrap this up because we've got a segment coming from our Tech on Reg show with Dara Chachowski that we want to share with everyone. But just before that, very quickly, JR, first of all, just in 30 seconds, if you're a CMO of a bank in coronavirus right now, what's the number one thing you'd be doing?
I'd be focusing on putting the transformation of people over the transaction of dollars and cents.
Okay, very good. All right. Where can we find the book?
Amazon, Banking on Digital Growth.
Very good. Brian, where can people keep up with what you're doing?
You can follow me on LinkedIn or follow me on Twitter at Claggett. I'm always there.
Very cool. And Chloe, thanks for joining us again.
I loved it. It was great chat with you guys.
Great to have you back in the hosting chair. All right, guys, now coming up is Dara Chachowski, the host of Tech on Reg, talking, connecting with us in terms of some of the regulatory issues in respect to diversity. Over to you, Dara.
I launched Tech on Reg to create thought-provoking conversations about our rapidly changing world. Together, we tackle the most pressing issues facing us today, particularly in technology, law, and disruptive industries. And I promise to create a forum that made diversity, equity, and inclusion a priority, not an afterthought, an actual central part of the conversation. And that means, to me, creating space to share knowledge, pain, and history in a way that paves a path towards growth and learning. I've been incredibly thankful to have the opportunity to speak with brilliant people from diverse backgrounds from around the world, and today's show is another step in that direction. The deaths of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Breonna Taylor have sparked action and a reckoning with history and institutionalized racism in the United States. From economic inequality to criminal justice to education, the events of the past few months and, as everyone knows, the subsequent responses remind us that there is much work to be done. Technology and dedicated founders like today's guest play a vitally important role. To help me have this important conversation, joining me today as a guest host is former Tech on Reg guest and executive director of FinTechs, Randy Rivera. And today, Randy and I will be talking to Daniel Rogers, founder of Chicago FinTech AM Money.
Is this a program that what you're building, is this a program solely for the wealthy? I mean, in the idea, let me kind of frame that question a little bit better. A lot of these loan programs that are out there and student lenders will say that they want us, they're equal opportunity lenders, but the reality is they're just carving a niche in the market that is like the creme de la creme. And I guess lending has been around for a while. How can you lend to a market that historically hasn't been lent to without taking on more risk?
Well, I might push on the premise that we're taking on more risk, right?
And yeah, sure.
A big part of what I've come to learn as a part of this process, because of course, as I said, I learned a lot, is that the risk is not anywhere close to what people would imagine it to be, right? And so I argue, I would like to think pretty convincingly that we aren't taking a disproportionate amount of risk, but we have an understanding of a population that other people simply don't have, right? And this kind of goes into like just think about the average person who works at an investment bank on a structured credit desk. Do you think that person has any appreciation for what it means for a person like me to work my way through college? In my experience working on those desks, the answer is no, right? And so we just kind of take that understanding, we marry that with the data that exists that tells that story and allows us to argue that point. And then, like, I would argue what we're doing is just simple arbitrage, right? We have an understanding of a market that other people don't have. And we provide an opportunity for people to get a return that's commensurate with the risk that they're actually taking.
Randy, I think that the way you framed that question was so interesting to me, because only every once in a while do I see your 17 years in financial services as a legit banker come out. And I feel like that question was like, I'm a former banker.
I couldn't help it. I mean, I want to talk.
Couldn't let that one go. Couldn't let it go.
I want to go down the path of talking about the risk metrics in the portfolio, but then we would have to put this all under, you know, do not disclose. We wouldn't be able to share anything because it's probably all proprietary.
Well, so if I may, like, I'll tell a story I had, you know, and I'll keep it as vague as I possibly can, right? But the bulk of the innovation that has happened in the student loan space, right, with all appropriate caveats up front, is in the super prime refi market, right? People like us who have gone to top schools of business, right, are offered lower rates because clearly the risk of default is that much less, right? And so I remember when I was starting the company, I was having a conversation with a person with experience in debt capital markets, we'll call it. And he was explaining to me the challenge I would have. Like, he said, when those companies were starting, right, and this is not my story, so if this is wrong, don't hold me personally responsible for it. But he said, like, what they did was go to, you know, the alums of those schools who worked on those structured credit desks and say, don't you want to buy a book of loans of people who went to this particular MBA program or went to this particular school? Because you have an understanding of the fact that the risk is that much less, right? Mm. And that's true, right? And then he went on to say, the problem that you're going to have is that you'll have a book of loans of people that look like you, people who grew up working class on the south side of Chicago, and that person will have no basic understanding of what you're talking about, right? And the challenge is not the numbers, because the numbers are the numbers. The challenge is, are people going to think critically about those numbers, and are they going to accept the conclusions of those numbers when it comes down to it, right? And so a big part of the process for us has always been, in some respects, of not even accepting the premise that it's riskier, but of arguing the point that it's not, and like showing our work and, as I kind of said previously, finding the people who are actually inclined to listen to that.
Daniel, one of the things that I've picked up in over the course of our conversations is that one of the interesting things about the space, unique things about the space, is the amount of data that you have access to, right? Historical student loan data in terms of performance. So, first of all, that data is only as good as it's relevant. And I think that there was in 2010 a very big change in the market. So first question is, how do you take the data from pre-2010, what happened in 2010, and then from 2010 to today to design the business that you're building right now? Because I think this is really interesting.
So the change you're kind of talking about is around that time in 2010, like the market structure changed. And that how it worked is that, to be simple about it, is that the federal student lending market basically subsidized for-profit actors to issue loans in which the government would give a guarantee to kind of prevent risk, right? And then they realized eventually that they're basically handing out a lot of money to companies for no good reason. And so eventually now, today, the bulk of loans are originated directly from the Department of Education, right? So what's interesting about that from a finance risk assessment perspective is that almost all of that information on how those loans are performed are public. And we have a very large amount of information that allows us to reconstruct what portfolios might look like under certain parameters if you have the presence of mind to parse through that data and you have an understanding of what it actually means, right? And so, you know, and that's before you kind of get to, you know, the additional research that a lot of institutions have done around, you know, who's on track to graduate from college, who's on track to find jobs, right? Like, you know, like these aren't, you know, questions without answers, right? But the financial markets haven't caught up to that yet, right? And so, because they're still predominantly looking at the income of the parents and the credit score of the individual, which is not necessarily wrong. As I always say, it's just incomplete. And so a big part of what's out there is a lot of data that tells us a really compelling story if we're inclined to go find it and to bring it to the people who guide these things.
So Daniel, quick question. I guess it has two parts. When we're thinking about sort of the unprecedented global pandemic that we've, you know, all been, literally every person on the planet has been dealing with for the past several months. One, what do you think the impact of COVID is on some of those existing portfolios now? And what do you think that impact will look like going forward?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you always have to be careful about making predictions, right? And like a big part of what's going on now are a lot of things happening at once that are on their own hard to kind of parse out, right? But, you know, in terms of how to think about it in the context of student loans, like effectively what you're underwriting is the probability of a person graduating and the probability of that person finding a job that's, you know, pays them enough to pay back the debt, right? And so what's interesting about student loans is that, like, when you look at the loss curves, and I don't know how in the weeds your audience is going to be about this stuff, and so I'll try and stay high level and push me down like further if you want. But like, there's a very consistent pattern, which is unlike other types of consumer asset classes, right? In that you see defaults spike in the first 3 years after a person leaves school, whether it be because they drop out or go to graduation. And then over time, that rate goes down. And for particular segments, particularly people who have graduated, you see very large amounts of people rehabbing those loans, right? And so what's going on there in practice is that, you know, if I've graduated from Northwestern, I've changed the trajectory of my life dramatically, right? But I haven't changed it immediately. I still have to find that job. I still have to, you know, get my first apartment. I still got to buy suits. I still got to buy a car. I still have to do all these things that are part and parcel of becoming an adult. And if I don't,
unless you're an entrepreneur, you don't have to buy a suit.
Right? I got to start a business. I got to incorporate in Delaware and do all that stuff, right? Which all comes with a cost. And if my parents can't write a check for $5,000, something has to give, right? And that's what we see, right? And particularly in communities of color. And so like when you talk about the stats around the default rates of African-Americans, right? When you dig deeper into that, you actually see for college graduates, they also rehab those rates and have comparable long-term repayment rates as their counterparts. But what's happening is that they're being stuffed into defaults for multiple reasons, at least which being like, what happens in the labor market and why it's harder for an African-American to find a job vis-a-vis their well-connected white counterpart, right? So to say all of that and to look at COVID is that all of those things are going to be exacerbated, right? Where people who had job offers like are going to see those job offers go away and those people are going to have to start their job hunt from scratch, which is going to introduce a lot more risk and variance into those loan performance, right? But I would argue, and I think the historical data shows this, is that over time they'll end up in the same place, the question, or a comparable place, right? But the question is, what do they have to pay on that pathway to that, right? Are they paying a higher interest rate? Are they paying a lot of default collection fees as a part of that process? Are they wrecking their credit and now paying 2 points higher on the credit card? Or I don't know anything about credit cards, but like, are they paying a higher rate on a credit card vis-a-vis their peers, right? And that's where it gets kind of like folded up, right? If I look 10 years in the future, I'm not worried about where that person from Northwestern is. I'm worried about the price they had to pay to get there.
Right. So it's interesting. So I saw Dara digging up paper, which always scares me because that means she found something over there.
Did.
What'd you find, Dara?
So I was doing a fair amount of research in preparation for our talk today. And this, what you just said sort of about the, it's going to take longer to find a job. What is really the cost of that time? And the three of us were talking earlier about sort of the, well, what else happens when, you know, the economy is garbage as people start pursuing advanced degrees if they're coming out of undergrad. And an interesting statistic that I found in the course of my OCD research, because it's important to be self-aware and know what you are, the American Council on Education has already studied this. And pre-COVID, pre the economy turning into garbage. The pursuit of graduate degrees is already significantly higher amongst minority students. And I think the statistic that the ACE found was that 57.2% of Black bachelor's degree graduates went on to pursue advanced degrees, while only 43.8% of white bachelor's degree holders did the same. So this population that, you know, students of color that we're talking about now, they were already pursuing advanced degrees in statistically significant percentages higher than white students. You add COVID into that, you add the cost of advanced degrees into that, you know, all of that sort of, I think, you know, multiplies and compounds the debt burden and the statistics around debt burden that we were talking about before. Does AM Money work with graduate students and programs as well?
Yeah, no. So like all of that is a great point, right? And like a big part of what's going into that is like just the need to do so, right? You know, like in Randy, I'm not sure like if you've had this experience, but you know, for me, people want to listen to me when I tell them I have an MBA from the University of Chicago, right? Like the things I tell them don't matter until I tell them I have a graduate degree. And by and large in the workforce, we know that to get promoted to comparable levels, people have to go to graduate school, right? So for me, graduate school is one of the few things from a risk perspective that keeps me up at night, right? Because in some cases, like getting an MBA from the University of Chicago, that's a great investment. Like, you know, if they double the price, it's probably still worth it. I haven't really run that math because I'm not that worried about it, right? Whereas you have a lot of graduate degrees, which allow you to take on a much larger amount of debt that don't allow you to take a comparable step forward in your career, particularly in regards to like what you can earn, right? And so we have been working on and have funded a few people for graduate school. And a big part of how we think about that is that we take a much more critical lens on what is that school, what is that program, where is that going to take you, and what is our comfort with the outcomes associated with that, you know? And in some cases, this is where the lines between for-profit and nonprofit actually blur a lot more, right? Like I took a very stark view on undergrad, like for for-profits, but there are some great nursing schools out there on the for-profit level, on the graduate side, that are very easy to get behind, right? Whereas you have some programs on the public side that, you know, taking out $150,000 to get a master's in social work, unless your parents are going to pay it off for you, never really makes a lot of sense, right? And so our model has been adapted to that. And we do look a lot more critically about what are those like specific outcomes for certain programs, simply because the risk for graduate school is that much greater as compared to undergrad.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
You can listen to all of our more than 300 episodes, plus all of the other shows from Provoke.fm Media, and learn more about being a guest, a partner, or a sponsor, all at Provoke.fm.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.